Hello. You are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind, LAB Radio. The LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. We're located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, and feature stories and more. The Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Again, I want to say good morning. My name is David. I'm usually the Monday reader with Paul, but I'm here today on Tuesday. Also, at 11 a.m. today, we will not be broadcasting any updated information because we're having our Christmas party here at 11. The Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and the Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Okay, so I'm going to read to you from today's Lowell Sun. It's Tuesday, December 9. And the lead article at the top of the fold, it talks about the Brian Walsh trial. And it says, with no body, prosecutors turn to blood. And then it's written by Colleen Cronin of the Boston Herald. This story. So it says jurors in the Brian Walsh murder case saw video footage of the defendant tossing a black plastic bag into a liquor store dumpster and buying cleaning supplies in the days following his wife Anna's disappearance. Prosecutors have already shown that they already shown the jury photos of brown, red stained pieces of carpet, tissues, and slippers, but a forensic scientist finally confirmed in court on Monday that those stains, as well as the others found inside the Walsh home, were blood. The Commonwealth is trying to prove that Walsh killed Anna in the early hours of New Year's Day, 2023. Although he pleaded guilty to lying to police about her disappearance and mishandling her body, Walsh maintains he's innocent on the murder charge. He instead claims that Anna died from sudden unexplained death and that he feared if he didn't cover it up, people might believe he murdered his wife and he would lose custody of his three boys. Jurors in the morning session at the Norfolk Superior Court got to hear some of this argument play out when the defense cross-examined Dr. Richard Atkinson, a forensic pathologist for the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner. Walsh's lawyer, Larry Tipton, asked Atkinson several questions about how someone could suddenly, now I got to go to page 7, that someone suddenly, I'm still trying to find page 7. That shouldn't be too difficult here. how suddenly and unexpectedly die from natural causes without injuries. People die suddenly quite often, but in a young person that has no medical history, yes, it's rare. When the prosecution had the opportunity to redirect, Atkinson said, there was no evidence of any type of death. There's no body to autopsy. Without a body, prosecutors turn to blood. In the afternoon, they called Matthew Sheehan, a forensic scientist at the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab. Sheehan said several brown red stains on the basement floor of the Walsh home tested positive for blood, as well as a few marks on the basement stairs. Sheehan also said a knife found above the refrigerator also tested positive. Although with the items from and the areas of the house, Sheehan testified that many items found in the dumpster where Walsh's phone was tracked also had blood on them, including snippers, a hammer, a hacksaw, a hatchet, towels, tissues, painter sheets, a sponge, two pairs of slippers, a Tyvek suit, and several cut-up pieces of carpet. In addition to the blood, Sheehan said he also observed some human hairs in the evidence. He also testified that the hatchet found in the dumpster had a greasy substance on the head, something he said was consistent with tools that had cut through human flesh to body fat. Oh, this gets worse. Samples were taken from the hatchet head and several items to be tested for DNA. Jurors also saw several videos of surveillance footage taken in the days after Walsh said Anna disappeared. In one video from New Year's Day, Walsh pulled up to a Swampscott liquor store near his mother's home that he was known to frequent and tossed away a black trash bag in a dumpster. and several other videos from the days that followed. Walsh buys cleaning supplies, including a mop, painter's buckets, rags, 3 64-ounce bottles of ammonia, and 5 bottles of hydrogen peroxide. At the self-checkout register at the Weymouth Lowe's, Walsh bought a new trash can, but instead of doing it alone, in the video from January 4, the day he reported Anna missing, one of his children is also seen in a shot with a blurred-out face. Walsh seems to look at himself in the live video footage from the checkout kiosk, fixing his hair in the reflection while his son uses the barcode scanner on the trash can with help from a Lowe's worker. Judge Diane Franeri estimated the trial about two-thirds of the way through so far. Only the prosecution has presented their case. Testimony is supposed to resume on Tuesday, which is today. So it's just a horrible story for Anna Walsh. Okay. I'm back to the front page. Another front page article says, former coach convicted of trying to send obscene material to a minor. And then in smaller print, it says, jury finds Lemeline guilty on 3 counts, sentencing stated for next March. Well, that's a long time waiting for sentencing. Okay, this is coming out of Boston. A former Burlington High School wrestling coach has been convicted in federal court on charges related to sending obscene material to what he believed was a 14-year-old girl. Court documents state that among the images Stephen James Lemelin, 51, sent to an undercover agent posing as a child was one in which he attempted to highlight his anatomy by placing it next to a can of Red Bull. Lemelin of Burlington was found guilty of 3 counts of attempted transfer of obscene material to a minor, a charge that carries a sentence of up to 10 years in prison, and is scheduled to be sentenced on March 26, according to U.S. Attorney Leah Foley's office. A criminal complaint filed by a special agent with the FBI states the case began in May of 2023 when an online covert employee with the FBI Child Exploitation and Human Trafficking Task Force posed as a 14-year-old girl on the text messaging platform Kik, K-I-K. Over several months, Lemelin is alleged to have engaged in sexually explicit conversations with the agent, sending multiple obscene photographs of himself. Prosecutors said he also posed, to meet the person for sex. The complaint states that investigators traced the KIK account to Very Nice Hung 8. Oh, gosh. Which used the screen name Steven Stretches back to Lemelin. This is terrible. On November 27, 2023, FBI agents executed search warrants for Lemelin's person, his residence on Glendale Road in Burlington, and his Kik account. That day, Lemelin was encountered by authorities walking his dog near his home, reading his rights, and agreed to speak with agents. He admitted chatting online with individuals he believed were under 18, sending 2 to 3 unsolicited, obscene images, including involving a can of Red Bull, and acknowledged being pretty aggressive in his online communications. According to the complaint, Lemelin voluntarily gave investigators the passcodes to a cell phone and 2 laptops. He also acknowledged at the time that he coached the high school's wrestling team, which is a boy and girls team. During a polygraph examination, Lemelin admitted to discussing sexual topics with the purported teen, including asking about her sexual experiences. He also confirmed that he discussed meeting her in person, though he claimed he never intended to follow through. Agents seized his electronic devices, including an iPhone 12 Pro Max found on his person. As part of the investigation, the criminal complaint states that videos involving young children, including girls estimated to be 2 to 9 years old, were discovered on a cell phone. This gets worse as every paragraph I read. According to Foley's office, Lemelin remains free, pending his sentence. Attempts to reach the Burlington School District for comment were unsuccessful. Lemelin's attorney, Anthony Riccio, declined to comment. The case was prosecuted under Project Safe Childhood, a program launched by the Department of Justice in 2006 to combat child sexual exploitation and abuse. The Burlington Police Department assisted with the investigation. Boy, that doesn't make you sick just reading that or hearing that. Okay, now I got another article on the front page, and it says $2 million bombshell with the Lowell High School project. And then they have a picture of the school on Kirk Street. And it says, where is it now? It says, on the south end of 1992 Lowell High School building on Kirk Street in downtown Lowell. It has a picture of it. So here's the article. It says, basement slab in Coburn Hall to be replaced. And then they put down $40,000 loan order fails, higher taxes forecasted. So this is coming out of Lowell. The city council heard a budgetary bombshell from Skanska project manager Jim Dowd, who told the body during its December 2nd meeting that the basement floor of the 1892 building would have to be replaced at a considerable cost. Dowd said the city's project manager on the Lowell High School rebuild renovation project, "We knew about the 1892 floor on July 24," Dowd said during his presentation to the council. "The money is coming out of the contingency. The cost is $2 million. Although the building project is roughly 75% completed, the original $21.2 million construction contingency has already been expensed." A construction contingency is money set aside to pay for change orders from new requests or unforeseen construction requirements. The $21 million was built into the initial $381 million budget figure for the project. In June, Dowd recommended the contingency be replenished for a total of almost $15 million, part of an overall budget. I have to go to page 8 now. Always cost overruns, always. But I'm glad they built in additional contingency money. So the $40 million cost overrun is a result of structural issues with the renovation of the basement slab in the 1922 building that in turn delayed the project timeline by an entire year from the summer of 2026 to 2027. The $2 million in slab repairs to the 1892 building is built into the overall figures. Councilors expressed surprise at this new construction development, and the issue was not raised by project team during the school building committee meeting on November 20. The high school project was designed by the architecture firm Perkins Eastman, is being built by Suffolk Construction and overseen by Skanska, the owner's project manager who represents the city's interest. The higher price on the four-phase project is now almost $422 million, with taxpayers paying the debt costs related to the $40 million overrun. City Manager Tom Golden told the council that as a result, the debt service will be 1.6% of the projected tax rate. That percentage will be on top of whatever the tax rate increase is for Golden called the cost of doing business in the city, which could be an additional 2.5 to 3%. When we come to set the tax rate in fiscal 2027, which is July 1 of next year, the first 1.6% is going to be for the high school, he said, which he called the largest public works project we've ever done in the city. Excuse me. This is not an easy situation. To the frustration of the councilors, Dowd could not guarantee that the increased contingency would be sufficient to complete phase four of the project. Dowd said he expected that many of the problems found in the 1922 building will also be found in the 1892 building, such as asbestos, a variety of wall types, in addition to the basement slab. In the nature of any renovation, as walls are taken down, items or encountered that weren't able to be in the original phase, explaining the role of a construction contingency to meet those costs. Phase one was the teardown of the old dentist's office on Arcan Drive and the old Riddick Fieldhouse, followed by the new construction of the Riddick Athletic Center that opened in 2022. Phase two was the construction of a five-story freshman academy on the footprint of the old gymnasium, the new cafeteria, and what the project team called Building D, which connects the gym, the freshman academy, and the 1980s building. That area included the main entrance and lobby off Father Morissette Boulevard. Phase three was the renovation of the 1980s building on the west side of the Merrimack Canal, or the West Campus. That portion was turned over in August. The other portion of phase three is north end of the 1922 building and is currently under construction. The classroom portion of that phase will be turned over January 5. The Cyrus Irish Auditorium will open in March. The replaced slab was part of this phase in the building that in that order and delayed the project completion date. Phase four is the southern portion of the 1922 building and the Coburn Hall, the 1892 building, the 100-year-old and the 130-year-old building, respectively. Councillor Corey Belanger worried that the project team would come back to the well again during phase four construction. "We think it's sufficient," Dowd said, "but in the nature of renovation, as I have said before to the school building committee and the council, you never know what you're going to encounter." Voting to approve the $40 million were Councilors Wayne Jennings, Rita Mercier, Kim Scott, Paul Rathayem, Sakara Chow, Mayor Daniel Rourke, and Belanger. Voting against the loan were Councilors Eric Gischer, John Descatow, Councilors Corey Robinson, and Vesna Nguyen were absent. The loan order vote did not pass since two-thirds of the councilors present did not vote in favor. The vote required 8 votes in favor. The vote is not on Tuesday's agenda, and it isn't clear what impact that failed vote has on the status of the construction project. In October, the school building committee approved a $2.2 million budget revision request to replenish the already depleted construction contingency. The money is needed, Dowd said then, to keep the temporary transfer of the money to keep... This doesn't read right. The temporary transfer of the money to keep paying the bills was in part due to the timing on the city amending the original bond loan order. If the council approves the loan order, the money will reimburse the expense funds and owner's contingency funds for the amount advanced to cover outstanding and anticipated invoices through the end of 2025. At the end of the public hearing with an affirmative vote, there's a 20-day referendum period. The funding doesn't become available until after the city has cleared the referendum period, at which time they can be spending against it. That window is now delayed by another week. But on Tuesday's agenda are two motions regarding Skanska's oversight of Gitcher's motions request to Golden to explore the process required to replace the owner project manager for the remainder of the high school project and to explore hiring a clerk of the works to protect the city's interest on the remainder of the high school project. Also on the council's agenda is a vote to cancel the December 23 and December 30 council meetings. The school building committee already voted to cancel its December meeting. The city council meets in the second floor chambers of City Hall at 375 Merrimack Street on Tuesday, December 9, that's today, at 6:30 p.m. to speak at a meeting. Contact City Clerk Michael Geary before 4 p.m. the day of the meeting at 978-674-4161. Okay, that ends that article. That covers all the articles on the first page. Let's see now. I'm going to go to page 3. Okay. And this is, it says schools mistakenly informed about funding loss. That's how it reads. The Healy administration says it mistakenly informed schools that it would not be distributing funding for a student financial literacy program because of the town's resistance to the controversial MBTA zoning law. Wachusett Regional High School and South Shore Vocational Technical were mistakenly informed that they were not eligible for Credit for Life grant awards. A spokesman for the State Office of Consumer Affairs and Business Regulation has told the Herald. This error has been corrected. The spokesperson added that the schools are now eligible. We apologize for any inconvenience. This comes after the schools received notices from the state about the funding loss last week, which appeared to continue the Healy administration's practice of withholding grants to communities resisting compliance with the MBTA Communities Act. State Senator Peter Durant, whose Central Massachusetts district includes Wachusett's, sounded the alarm before Thanksgiving about the notice. The Republican urged the Healy administration to restore the $3,200 grant. Wachusett's Regional High School serves more than 1,700 students in Worcester County from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling. Durant argued that the 5 community district was being unfairly punished because of Holden's policy dispute with the administration. Holden has resisted the law, with residents in the town of nearly 20,000 shooting down a multifamily zoning bylaw at a town meeting last spring. Durant indicated that the community is set to vote on a new proposal in February. Durant is expressing relief that Wachusett Regional will ultimately receive the grant funding for the Student Financial Literacy Program. I am so glad to know that the cooler heads have prevailed and the students of the district won't be denied the opportunity to learn financial life skills, Durant said in a statement. It is important to speak out when we see situations we feel are unjust, he added, as this was especially when young people are impacted. Okay, that ends that article. Okay, here's the 5-minute read in the Lowell Sun. Mahoney Family Fund raises $28,000. Former Tewksbury resident Maureen Mahoney, along with former Lowell Police Superintendent Ed Davis and current Middlesex District Attorney Marion Ryan, spoke at an October 9 ceremony to honor the 50th anniversary of the deaths of Dr. Hugh Ruth and John Maloney at the Indian Ridge Country Club in Andover. Mahoney's parents and her younger brother were killed in a home invasion on New Year's Eve in 1975. The event also recognized the 10-year anniversary of the Mahoney Family Fund, which is dedicated to the well-being of children and families. In collaboration with many nonprofits and businesses, the nonprofit works to mitigate child abuse and domestic violence. Davis and Ryan spoke about the need to prevent exposure childhood to violence and to mitigate generational abuse. A live auction, donations, and sponsorships raised almost $28,000 for the fund. And if you want more information about the fund, it's MahoneyFamilyFund.com. Okay, here's the holiday concert in Chelmsford. The Chelmsford Community Band rings in the holiday season with a concert band performance of seasonal favorites on Sunday, December 14th, so that's this Sunday, at 2 p.m. at the McCarthy Middle School at 250 North Road in Chelmsford. This year's program includes a musical accompaniment to the beloved poem, "'Twas the Night Before Christmas." Dawson's arrangement of O Come, Emmanuel, a medley of tunes from the overture to the Muppet Christmas Carol and other favorite holiday tunes will also be played. Admission to the concert is free, but donations are always accepted so that the band can continue to operate. Suggested donations are $10 for adults and $20 for families. The 70-piece concert band and the 20-piece jazz ensemble are composed of volunteer musicians bringing live musical performances to the community since 1972. The band is supported by the Massachusetts Cultural Council grants and community donations. And then it says, for more information, visit ChelmsfordCommunityBand.com. And the last, oh no, there's quite a few articles here. Community Christmas Chorus, and this is coming out of Westford. The Community Christmas Chorus presents its annual concert to raise money and collect food for the Westford Food Pantry on Sunday, December 14th. That's again this Sunday at 7 p.m. at the First Parish Church at 84 Main Street at Westford Common. 31 singers from several area towns, directed by Rene Renault, will perform sacred songs dating from the High Renaissance to the 21st century, and a lively arrangement of Jingle Bells. The women's ensemble Elements will also perform, and the program includes a special performance by Donna Olson, a Westford native and a voice teacher who has leading roles in opera and oratorio throughout the country. The program features an audience carol sing-along. Suggested donation for the admission is $5 a person, $15 for family, plus two non-perishable food items for the food pantry. All money collected at the door will be donated to the pantry. Okay, next one. Save the Date, Wetlands Project. This is coming out of Tewksbury. The Tewksbury Community Development Department hosts a follow-up meeting to share updated design plans for the upcoming restoration work at the former Poplar Street site and the Molly Drive site Tuesday, December 16th, so that's a week from today, at 5:30 p.m. at the town hall in the first floor meeting room, 1009 Main Street. This meeting is open to the public and no registration is required. The goal of this session is to provide an update to previously presented plans related to the floodplain, groundwater, and wetland restoration work planned for the Poplar Street and Molly Drive sites within the Shawshene River watershed to restore ecological function and solicit feedback. This plan revision incorporates feedback received at past outreach events and written comments from the public. Staff will walk through the 60% design plans and provide an outline for the next steps before opening the room up to questions. For more information, email conservation agent Abigail Mahoney at mahoney@tewksbury-mass.gov or town planner Alexandra Louder at alouder@tewksbury-mass.gov. And it says here, this is how it reads. If Molly was involved, I didn't have to worry about it. And then it says below it in a little bit smaller print, former colleague, remember Molly Sheehan and her legacy at MCC's expansion to Lowell. Okay, so this is coming out of Lowell. Middlesex Community College is a fixture of downtown Lowell. And for that, you definitely have to thank Molly Sheehan. Molly died on October 12 at the age of 87, but with her passing, she left behind a legacy that can be seen in Lowell every single day with the Middlesex Community College's campus in the city. Middlesex Community College originally opened in 1970 with just its campus in Bedford, but in 1987, the college was looking to expand into Lowell and placed an ad in the Sunday morning edition of The Sun for an open job to be the MCC of Lowell Outreach Coordinator. Molly took on the role, bringing her experience as an educator in Billerica and officially becoming the first employee for the new campus. Her husband, then State Senator Paul Shee, then helped secure state funding to get MCC started in Lowell. Molly became a trusted member of the college's... I think I have to go to page 8. Let's see. Okay, page 8. She became a leadership and later a dean, serving under Middlesex Community College President James Houlihan. In a letter to the... In a letter to the campus community a few days after Molly's passing, current Middlesex Community College President Phil Sisson said she was the first person he met on campus 15 years ago when he first applied for the role of Provost and Vice President of Academic Affairs. Beyond her role in establishing Middlesex Community College in Lowell, Sisson credited Molly with spearheading a number of other local and international initiatives throughout her career. At Middlesex, she helped establish the Wider Horizons program, an extension of the Irish Peace Initiative that brought together teachers from north and south of Ireland to study in the United States, said Sisson. She was also instrumental in the actualization of the Lowell Middlesex Academy Charter School, a program she helped oversee for decades. She became the college's direct liaison with other public school partners, first in Lowell, and then as outreach expanded to some other neighboring communities as well. Sisson pointed out how just the weeks before Molly was recognized for all her contributions to the Middlesex Community College during the college's 55th anniversary celebration, she touched thousands of lives during her career, Sisson said, and her fingerprints on the development of our Lowell campus and our Lowell educational partnerships are indelible. Molly made it her passion to make sure that all students would be welcomed through the doors of Middlesex Community College, and she was usually one of the first people to greet them in her lobby. A smile on her face and the entire time, said Sisson. In her 27 years at Middlesex, Molly engaged in innumerable community events, became one of our most stalwart ambassadors of affordable higher education, and was truly the gold standard champion of our city of Lowell outreach efforts. Cowan first met Molly when she was first being hired at MCC. Doble had asked Cowan to have lunch with Molly to get an impression of the hopeful hire. She was someone clearly cared about the city, said Cowan. When Molly was first hired, when MCC was first expanding into Lowell, Cowan said she played a key managing role as things were being set up. She really brought everything together on the startup, said Cowan. She was managing the physical space, making sure the faculty's needs were all met. She was a terrific woman, and I have nothing but the deepest respect for her and her contributions to the college and the city. She loved Lowell like nobody I had ever met before. For the rest of her career after, Cowan said Molly was able to make connections between college and different parties of the city, like the Lowell schools. If she saw an opportunity, she was someone who could see that opportunity and make that happen. She could see a future with the different relationships, and I think it just translated to success no matter what she touched. As president, I always felt if Molly was involved, I didn't have to worry about it. University of Massachusetts President and former Congressman Marty Meehan spoke highly of Molly and noted it is difficult to talk about her without talking about Paul, who died in 2014. Meehan first met Molly in 72 when Paul was first running for the legislature. The pair, Meehan said, were a remarkable couple. I grew up watching Molly blaze trails in education. She is a woman who helped shape civic life in the city of Lowell. Meehan noted Molly's status as a Triple River Hawk as she obtained her undergraduate degree from the Lowell State Teachers College, which evolved into the Lowell State College and eventually UMass Lowell. Molly then got her master's and her doctorate degrees from UMass Lowell. Even beyond education, Meehan said Molly's passion and purpose in her life. If you want to think about how to live your life, Molly is a good person to look to, said Marty Meehan. Okay, all right, that's a pleasant article. Let's see now, where am I? I'm on page, I've read all of page three. Page two is just local, international news or national news, so I'll skip that for now. Okay, let's do what took place on this date. Again, now today is December 9th. So now I want to talk to you about today in history on this day. So in 2014, on December 19th, U.S. Senate investigators concluded concluded the United States had brutalized scores of terror suspects with interrogation tactics that turned secret CIA prisons into chambers of suffering and did nothing to make Americans safer after September 11, 2001 attacks. On this date, in 1854, Alfred Lloyd Tennyson's famous poem, The Charge of the Light Brigade, was published in England. In 1911, an explosion inside the Cross Mountain coal mine near Brisville, Tennessee, killed 84 workers. Wow. In 1917, British forces captured Jerusalem from the Ottoman Turks. In 1965, a Charlie Brown Christmas, the first animated TV special featuring characters from Peanuts comic strip by Charles Schutz, premiered on CBS. In 1987, the first Palestinian Intifada, an uprising, began as riots broke out in Gaza and spread to the West Bank, triggering a strong Israeli response. In 1990, Solidarity founder Lech Walesa won Poland's presidential runoff by a landslide. In 1992, on this date, Britain's Prince Charles and Prince Diana announced their separation. In 2000, the U.S. Supreme Court ordered a temporary halt in the Florida vote count in which Al Gore pinned his best hopes of winning the White House. I do remember that day. In 2006, a fire broke out at a Moscow drug treatment hospital, killing 46 women trapped by barred windows and a locked gate. In 2011, the European Union said 26 of its 27 members were open to joining a new treaty tying their finances together to solve the euro crisis. Britain remained opposed. And finally, in 2020, commercial flights with Boeing 737 MAX jetliners resumed for the first time since they were grounded worldwide nearly 2 years earlier following two deadly accidents. So, okay, so that ends that article. And that makes me go to another page. And I do have the opinion page now of the Lowell Sun. Okay, so here's the opinion page, the editorial from the Lowell Sun today. And it reads, recent poll, latest reason to support school cell phone ban. Okay, the education establishment, state senate and governor support it. And recently released poll indicates that most parents also back a proposed bell-to-bell ban on cell phone use by students in the state's public schools. That support does not come with a caveat. Parents also want a clear policy on how to contact their children if necessary during the school day. The State House News Service reported in a survey released Wednesday by Mass INC Polling Group on behalf of the Education Trust, 66% of parents with children in grades 6 through 12 say they support legislation that would prohibit students from having cell phones or other electronic devices in their possession for the entire school day. That support includes 40% who said they strongly support the measure. Meanwhile, 63% of those parents said they want to know how they could contact their child during the school day under such a ban, and 49% said they would want a detailed explanation of the policy, including any exceptions. The polls surveyed 1,351 K through 12 parents, including 890 parents with children in grades 6 through 12. Since 88% of those older students reported having a cell phone or smartwatch, it's undoubtedly a pervasive issue that affects most families. The ban elicited consistently strong positive sentiment across racial lines, with the highest among white parents, 41%, Asian parents, and Pacific Islander parents at 48%. Fathers, 46%. Parents over the age of 45, 47%. Mass INC also conducted a focus group in September with parents of middle and high school students. Participants expressed broad support for limiting distractions in classrooms, while also raising concerns about the safety and communication emergency situations. Many parents noted that their children rely on phones for transportation coordination, mental health support, and in rare instances of bullying. The poll and the parental feedback provide valuable input as the legislature considers a statewide ban. In July, the Senate overwhelmingly approved a bell-to-bell ban that would require all public school districts to restrict personal electronic devices during the school day starting in 2026-27 academic year. Supporters say the measure would reduce the distractions, improve academic performance, reduce cyberbullying, and encourage social interaction in classrooms. The legislation should assure parents' accessibility concerns. Local education officials could include variations in their bans that align with the development of a level of students and of the structure of the school day in each grade level in school. It also includes exceptions for students with medical needs or individualized education plans and requires schools to provide a method for parents to contact children during the day. Massachusetts has a proud history of supporting and uplifting K through 12 public education for our students. But a device small enough to fit into a pocket presents a profound challenge to ensuring student success, Senate President Karen Spilka, in a statement accompanying the bill's passage. The bill awaits a response from the House, which just recently, through House Budget Chairman Aaron Mitchowitz, signaled its willingness to entertain the measure. Following the passage of the Senate bill, House Speaker Ron Mariano, a former educator, said that he recognizes that phones are a distraction in schools and that he also understands concerns raised by some parents worried about how to keep in contact with kids during emergencies. If approved by the legislature and signed into the law by the governor, Massachusetts would join a growing list of states that have enacted some form of cell phone ban during school hours. As of July, 32 states, in addition to Washington, D.C. and the Virgin Islands, had a law or policy on the books covering K through 12 classroom or school cell phone usage, according to the Ballotpedia. At least 21 states, in addition to Washington, D.C. and the Virgin Islands, have completely banned wireless communication devices, including personal phones or tablets. One of the most recent to join that list, our neighbor, the North, New Hampshire. Governor Kelly Ayotte in June signed a bell-to-bell cell phone ban into law, which prohibits students to use the use of personal devices from the first bell to the last, with exceptions for medical disability needs. Cell phone bans have attracted bipartisan support among participating states. Other states with strong cell phone restrictions during school hours include Florida, Louisiana, Vermont, North Carolina, Oregon, New York, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Utah. Most also include exceptions for specific circumstances. Other states banning cell phones in schools have either mandated or encouraged individual districts to create their own policies, often with specific deadlines or guidelines. They include California, Minnesota, New Mexico, Arizona, Arkansas, Virginia, West Virginia, Nebraska, North Dakota, and Iowa. Health experts have clearly outlined the potential physical and behavioral risks that extended cell phone use poses for adolescents. That's only magnified in an academic setting where distractions like cell phones can interrupt the attention to detail necessary to master subject matter. It's time for Massachusetts to join the growing list of states instituting a cell phone ban during school hours, which include clear policies for certain educational needs and parental access. House leadership should expedite its deliberations and send this bill to the governor. Okay. Yeah, I agree. Cell phones are a distraction, but parents want the ability to contact their children in a case of emergency. So somehow they have to figure out that solution. Okay. Let's see. Where am I going now on the Lowell Sun here? Because the Lowell Sun seems to get smaller and smaller as far as the articles that they print out every day. Okay. Okay, here's an article. It says, more people are caring for dying loved ones at home. Okay. Liz Dungaback isn't dying, but for a recent end-of-life care workshop in New Orleans, she pretended to be. Dungaback lay still atop a folding table and was dressed as a bed, complaining that her legs hurt. Registered nurse Anna Qualis, rolling up two small white towels, demonstrated how to elevate her ankles to ease the pain. Mom's legs are always swollen. Raise them up. About 20 New Orleans residents listened intently, eager to learn more about how to care for loved ones at home when they're nearing the end of their lives. Attendee Alex Vargas said she used to be terrified of dying, but about 3 years ago, a close cousin's death led her to attend group writing workshops, helping her embrace her grief and conquer her fear. I'm feeling very called towards this work, she said. It's definitely knowledge that I wanted to obtain and expand my mind in that way. And this is also something that we're all going to encounter in our lives. The workshop made her think about a neighbor whose mother has dementia. I was immediately thinking, okay, there's someone in my immediate orbit that is experiencing this, Vargas recalled. Here's a practical way to put the mutual aid in use. Demand for home health care, including at-home hospice care, has skyrocketed since the onset of the COVID pandemic, and as has the number of family caregivers. An estimated 63 million people in the United States, nearly a quarter of all American adults, provide care over the previous year to another person with a medical condition or disability, usually another adult, according to the 2024 survey by the AARP. Nearly one in five Americans expected to be 65 or older by 2030. Healthcare experts predict the demand at home caregivers will continue to rise. Online resources for end-of-life care also widely available. But hands-on training to prepare people to become caregivers is not, and it can be expensive. Yet untrained family members turned caregivers are taking on nursing and medical tasks. Donald Trump promised more support for caregivers during his 2024 campaign, including a pledge to create new tax credits for those caring for the family members. He endorsed a bill reintroduced in Congress this year that allow family caregivers to receive tax credits of up to $5,000, but the legislation hasn't moved forward. Meanwhile, the Medicaid cuts expected from the Republicans' One Big Beautiful Bill, which Trump signed in July, could prompt states looking to offset their added expenses to reconsider participation in optional state Medicaid programs. So it's very interesting to know that more and more Americans are living longer than they have, and more want to be having care at home. And so this is becoming much more of a critical stage for the younger generation to care for the older people. So, very interesting. So, as I started out in the beginning of the broadcast, we usually read the local newspapers from 10, well, really from 9 to 12 p.m. But today at the Lowell Association for the Blind, they're having their Christmas party starting at 11. So we are not going to be broadcasting the second hour of, the 10 o'clock broadcast. So, a couple of things I'd like to just say is you are listening to the Lowell, or you have been listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB radio, and the lab radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. And the lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. And finally, we want to say thank you for listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB radio. The lab radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, and there are three ways you can listen to us. One way is to call us at the lab at 978-454-5704, and we can then send you a free specialized radio receiver. Another way to listen to us is dial this phone number, 1-631-359-9069. And the third way is to go to our website, LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. So I want to thank you again for listening. We are going to sign you back off to the Marshfield Broadcasting. And then tomorrow morning, we will be reading from our local newspapers again for you. So bye-bye for now.